Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Cover Story by New Books Network, a podcast where we talk to people who write, edit, and publish long-form journalism. My name is Aga Popenda, and today we're talking with ProPublica investigative journalist Justin Elliott. Hi, Justin. How are you?
Hey, good. Good to be here.
Justin writes about business, economics, money, and influence in politics. He has produced stories for the New York Times and NPR. And his work on TurboTax maker Intuit, the story that we will be discussing today, won an award for business journalism. And Justin, you will be celebrating a decade at ProPublica next year, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I joined in 2012.
Right. And I would like to ask you, could you tell us about your career before that and how you got there, how you get to ProPublica?
Sure. I got into journalism, like a lot of people, in college, and I did a lot of work at the college newspaper, instead of doing my homework and focusing on classes. And then I was actually intending this was in the kind of mid 2000s. I was intending to, become a newspaper reporter. But I sort of graduated at the kind of early stages of the decline of the old print newspaper industry. So I did work at newspapers a little bit, but really most of my early career was in online media. I was a fact checker at Mother Jones magazine, out in San Francisco. And I also wrote a little bit for the website. And then I spent a couple of years at a political website or kind of political blog called Talking Points Memo, which is a small company based in New York where I focused on reporting on political corruption and politics more generally. And then I spent a couple of years at Salon, which was an old, one of the first online media companies, which has gone through a lot of changes over the years. When I was there, I was a politics reporter. Then I landed at ProPublica in 2012, originally focusing on sort of money and politics and those kinds of issues. But in the last 5 or 6 years, I've become more of a business reporter, although it's sometimes writing about kind of the intersection of business and politics. But I've written about antitrust issues and various companies, including Intuit, the tax prep company, as you mentioned. So that's the short version.
Mm-hmm. And was it your intention to do investigative journalism, or is it a coincidence?
Yeah, it was my intention. I think I sort of got hooked on reporting more generally in college, just having kind of a license to pick up the phone and just call people and ask questions was sort of a thrilling discovery in college. And I did always sort of like the digging aspects of reporting. I think that there's, I think there tend to be reporters who are, uh, more animated by the kind of love of reporting, and there's some reporters who are more animated by love of writing. And I've kind of always been in the former category. I never really had like a specific goal or anything, but I'm happy where I ended up.
Mm-hmm. So you do produce long form journalism, but you don't act like a magazine writer. And one of the striking differences is accessibility. You really want people to find you and contact you. And I was wondering about the consequences of being accessible to your sources and pretty much to everyone else. That sounds stressful.
Yeah, I mean, my phone number is right out there on the internet, which is something I started doing. This point is probably 6 or 7, maybe 8 years ago, after I spent a year or two doing a series of stories about the American Red Cross, which is, you know, a big disaster relief nonprofit. And that was a story where you had this organization with a huge number of employees, and there was really no one else in the press writing about a bunch of problems internally at the Red Cross and externally in terms of how effective they were at providing disaster relief. And I realized during that project that it was, the simple act of just sort of putting a line at the bottom of a story that says, look, this is what I'm interested in. If you have information about this, or if you want to make comments or complain about what I've written, tell me something's wrong, here's my phone number and email. And that turns out to be like somewhat surprisingly a really powerful tool. I think maybe because a lot of people who are not working in media would not necessarily reach out to a reporter unprompted. So even having that kind of little note saying that we welcome that kind of thing, or I welcome that kind of thing, is really effective.
Do you ever pick up your phone and you regret that your cell phone is online and everybody can call you?
Oh yeah. That definitely happens. And I think that's just kind of an occupational hazard. Nothing too terrible has happened yet. But awesome. I mean, as you say, I mean, the other thing about the kind of reporting that I do, and a lot of my colleagues at ProPublica do, is, you know, usually the subjects of our stories are not giving us access, even though on the one hand we want potential sources and just our readers to be able to contact us. Usually the people and organizations that are the actual subjects of our stories are not inviting us to, you know, spend a day shadowing them in the way that you might if you were writing a profile of Bruce Springsteen or something like that. Right. And so that really affects the kind of stories you can write, because you can't, it becomes more difficult to do the kind of stories where you are spending a bunch of time with someone in intimate spaces and that kind of thing, and can kind of describe what you're seeing. You can do that sometimes, but more often what you have to try to do is to kind of write around those limits on your access to your subject. And that's also one of the reasons why, it's really important for us to tell people out there that might know things about the subjects that we're writing about that we want to hear from them, even if we're not writing about those people.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about how you guys work in ProPublica and how those stories or projects are being assigned. So the story of how 70% of Americans should be filing their taxes for free, but no one is actually really able to pull it off. You started to work on it with another colleague as early as 2013. Then you did a lot of work on IRS and companies offering services like TurboTax in 2019, and you continued to press. So how those big projects that take sometimes many years are being assigned and monitored? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat organic. Usually the ideas bubble up from the reporters, and then we kind of get a thumbs up or a thumbs down from the editors. And if you get the thumbs up, then you go off and try to do the story. In this particular case, actually, my former colleague, a woman named Liz Day, who now works at the New York Times, was the one that sort of originated this whole series for us, writing about these tax prep companies, the biggest of which is Intuit, which makes TurboTax, and kind of getting into why it is that so many Americans have to pay a private company in order to perform this kind of basic act of citizenship of filing taxes. And so Liz wrote some early stories about this. I was involved in some of those going way back as you said, I believe 2013. But we really started to focus on this in 2019, and the way that it developed was fairly typical for how these projects begin, at least for me, which was I was preparing some stories not about this topic, but about the Trump tax overhaul, a new tax law that was passed in 2017. And as I was doing that reporting, one of the people I was talking to flagged to me that Congress was about to pass a law that included language that would ban the IRS, the tax agency, from creating its own sort of free tax filing system for citizens of the country. And so I decided, because it was around the tax filing deadline, this was in the kind of late winter, early spring of 2019, to do a quick story flagging this legislation. And what happened was we published that story, a short story, like 1,000 words, something like that. And that was when the first source, somebody that had worked at Intuit, started talking to me after seeing that story. Some of the things that person told me, and then later things that other people told me, convinced me, and then my colleague Paul Keel, who I worked with on this, that there was definitely a bigger story here. So I dropped some of the other things I was working on related to the Trump tax law and decided to focus on this. And then it was 6 or 7 months later that we finally published our sort of long account of the whole history of how tax prep came to be, how it is in the U.S. So it was really, as is often the case with these things, it was really driven by sources and by the fact that people who were, people who had interesting information, who were troubled by things that they'd seen, came forward. So it's really very much driven by sources and people who have a conscience, basically.
Yeah. So going to the heart of the story, I'm one of the millions of Americans who every year plans to pay my taxes for free. And usually I lose patience. This year, I believe I paid for my state return. Mm-hmm. You mentioned this this proposal to ban IRS from developing their own software. But am I correct that there was also another deal about 15, 20 years ago when initially IRS and tax companies made an agreement who does what? And then originally IRS was banned from offering their free service. Could you tell us a bit about it? You know much more
about it than absolutely. I
do. Yeah.
Absolutely. So the kind of short version is that, as you said, I mean, about 20 years ago, actually during the George W. Bush administration, right in the period where personal computing and the internet was really was taking off, and it was clear, we're talking around the year 2000, 2001, that everyone was going to have a computer, even if everyone didn't have one yet, or most people. There was a proposal that actually came out of the Bush administration that said, hey, the IRS has been, for all these years, people have been filing paper tax returns and sending them into the IRS, and it's really inefficient for you know, the IRS to be getting all this paper and processing it. So it obviously makes sense to do this via computer. So the IRS should develop its own free, electronic tax prep, basically website. and that should be available to Americans. And this is something that, you know, now many developed countries have. And Intuit, which is the Silicon Valley company that makes TurboTax, was already a big player at the, back then. TurboTax was not the website that most people use today, but instead it was like software that you'd buy on like a disk or a CD. But it was already a big, really profitable business. So what our investigation found, and we got all kinds of internal documents from Intuit laying this out, was that the company, basically when this proposal from the Bush administration for the IRS to create its own system came out, you know, sirens started going off inside Intuit because they saw this as an existential threat, I think correctly, to this profitable TurboTax business. So the company intervened in Washington, the kind of classic hiring, you know, lobbyists, doing a full court press with local members of Congress and so on. And ultimately successfully, they put forward a counterproposal. And the counterproposal was to the IRS, hey, instead of you, the government, creating a free tax filing system that everyone can use, you don't worry about that. And we will enter into a public-private partnership under which we, the tax prep industry, will create our own free tax prep option that will be available to most Americans. And you don't have to worry about it. But in exchange, you have to promise to us that you will never create your own system that will be a sort of public competitor to TurboTax. Mm-hmm. So the federal government agreed to this, and this is basically the regime that we're still living under. And, you know, when you first hear the description, it doesn't necessarily sound like a terrible idea. Again, this is most Americans are actually eligible to use this free option. But what we found is that the history of this public-private partnership over the last 20 years has been Intuit and the rest of the industry taking deliberate steps to make sure that as few people as possible can actually find and use this free option. So very few people find and use it every year, even though the majority of Americans are eligible because it's made so difficult to find and use. And instead, the companies led by Intuit, you know, make billions and billions of dollars from fees from people that actually are technically eligible to use this free version, but it has never been properly marketed and put out there. And so that's sort of the short version of like the 20-year history that we were trying to tell.
Mm-hmm. And since then, we had a few administrations, and I was wondering, right now we have a Biden administration. Don't we have a champion for the cause in the Congress? Why this thing is not being fixed?
Well, there are a few champions for the U.S. to create a sort of public, a free public option in Congress. I mean, Elizabeth Warren actually and Bernie Sanders have both mm-hmm. been on this for years, as well as other members of Congress. And also, it's worth noting that the United States is really an outlier in this respect. I mean, without getting too much into the weeds about the mechanics of taxes, the IRS, if you have a normal job, an uncomplicated tax situation, which most people have, the IRS actually already has all the data that goes onto your tax return. So like when ProPublica pays me a salary, they are separately sending the IRS information saying we're paying Justin this much money. And so how it works in many developed countries is the tax collection agency takes this data that they already have and essentially just fills out your tax form for you. You look it over and just say essentially like click yes if you're okay with this. That's sometimes called like a return-free system. So that would be an even further step to making things easier for most people. You know, the reason, first of all, the Biden administration hasn't really said anything about this issue, as far as I know. They have actually proposed a significant increase to the IRS budget. But so far, that's mostly been focused on increasing audit rates and enforcement, which is something that has also sort of fallen off in recent years under budget cuts. But look, I think it's a classic case where you have, if the government took steps to make this easier and free for more people, it's a classic situation where it would create distributed benefits to many people, but concentrated harm to this industry and particularly Intuit. And so the industry has a huge incentive to, spend huge amounts of money on lobbying and campaign donations to make sure that this never happens. And so far, that has been quite effective for 20 years.
And I bet for the story, you talk with a bunch of people, including employers of all those companies, but also people from IRS. And I was wondering if you're being treated differently by, let's say, IRS public servants that are just simply underfunded, but are really great. And let's say those capitalist sharks that probably don't want to talk to you. I was wondering how you've been treated when you reach out to both.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, actually. I mean, the IRS, in my experience, writing about tax issues, both including this TurboTax issue and other tax policy issues, the IRS actually almost never comments on anything. And so actually, we got much more engagement from Intuit than the IRS. I mean, Intuit never agreed to actually sit down for an interview. Like, I was never able to have a kind of free-flowing question and answer exchange with an Intuit executive, but their spokesperson was actually very responsive in sending me kind of written statements that we, you know, incorporated into the story, into the various stories we did. The IRS did not really speak to us. We actually, as part of this reporting, my colleague Paul Keel and I filed a series of Freedom of Information Act requests to get records of interest to us from the IRS, and we ended up having to actually file a lawsuit. One of our attorneys at ProPublica, Jeremy Kuttner, led that effort, and we successfully got the IRS to release some documents showing how cozy the agency had become with industry, which is another whole aspect of this. A revolving door between people leaving the IRS and going to, you know, more highly compensated positions at Intuit. Really the key sources for this story were really neither the IRS nor Intuit, but instead it was people that current and former employees at Intuit and other tax prep companies that were really the reason why we were able to do any of this. Again, people that generally speaking were troubled by some of the tactics the company was using, and some of the positions it was taking around this, frankly took risks in talking to us, because they want to see, this information get out there. So that was really the foundation of the stories.
So in your work, you rely a lot on FOIAs, and I was wondering if, if agencies like IRS are potentially using the pandemic to slow things even more down. I wondered how the pandemic affected your work. Do you have to wait longer for things to get back to you?
Most of this work I was doing pre-pandemic, thankfully, but look, even pre-pandemic, my view of FOIA is at least with many federal agencies, that the law is basically totally broken. It's been gutted through, kind of systematic underfunding. So, I mean, I literally have FOIA requests in with like the State Department that I filed like over 10 years ago. There's sort of a spectrum of responsiveness among agencies. And I think part of the fault, or perhaps most of the fault, is with Congress for not appropriating more money to actually make sure the agencies can follow the law, because the law is just consistently violated. I mean, you're supposed to get a substantive response within a few weeks, and it basically never happens at the federal level. I've had much better luck actually with state level public records laws. As I was saying, I mean, we're lucky at ProPublica that we have the resources to occasionally file lawsuits, in federal court under the Freedom of Information Act. And this was a case where we decided to do that, and that does tend to get the agency's attention, and did in this case work. So FOIA, unfortunately, is very frustrating, but we still try to use it sometimes.
Do you believe that with more funding, IRS could resolve this problem for all of us, or do you think that we would need Congress to act in order to, for this 70% of Americans to be able to file their taxes for free?
You know, that's a great question. I think there are some steps that the IRS could take to better promote the existing program that would make a difference. I think that a more serious overhaul would probably require some sort of intervention by Congress, and it's totally unclear whether that will ever happen. One thing that is happening as a result of our stories is that there's a series of lawsuits have been filed, both private lawsuits on behalf of Americans that paid for tax prep that they should have gotten for free or that they were eligible to get for free, and then also actually some lawsuits have been filed by state actors, including the LA city attorney. And these things take a while. So they're even though some of these actions started way back in 2019, they're still going on. But there may be some kind of relief or settlements as a result of the various litigation that's happening. Mm-hmm. But right now, I mean, I certainly haven't seen any indication that Congress is planning to get involved in this at the moment, but it's very hard to predict these things.
Is there a state in the US that is taking care better of their taxpayers in this regard?
That's a very good question. You know, I'm not an expert on the state level taxes. I only know that in New York, where I live, it's a pain to fill out the state tax returns. Although, by the way, you can use. I guess we're recording this a couple of days after the actual tax deadline, so maybe it doesn't matter anymore. But the free filing option you should be able to use if you're under the income threshold. For eligibility, you should be able to use for both state and federal. I'm not an expert on the state level system, so I don't have a great answer to that.
You wrote so many exciting stories about the treatment of Muslims in New York under Bloomberg, about congressional trips abroad, about NSA transparency, and as you mentioned, corporate takeover of the Red Cross. Would you be able to identify your favorite and least favorite stories? Anything from funny to scary to just simply, satisfying to you as a journalist?
You mean the stories themselves or yeah. In the reporting process? I think the most interesting stories for me in recent years have been in the sort of business and economics realm. My colleague and I, Jesse Eisinger, who's a business reporter and editor at ProPublica, did a story a few years ago investigating this world of academic economists who have side gigs consulting on corporate merger cases. So like this is an antitrust story. And basically what these economists do is create arguments for large companies that want to convince the government to allow their mergers to go through. And basically convince the government that this is not going to harm competition and harm consumers in the country. And so it was really a privilege and quite interesting to have the time to delve into this kind of obscure world that almost no one ever writes about of antitrust economists that actually have a big influence on really everything in the country. And so I think the best part about being a ProPublica reporter is just having having the time and support of the organization to get into these areas that are undercover, but we think important, and the time to really dig in and try to convince people to that's a good idea to talk to us to, in order to get these stories out.
Another tricky and fascinating story was your reporting on media companies that were lobbying and probably still lobbying against transparency. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So this was actually way back in the 2012 political campaign cycle, and the details are a bit wonky, but basically there was an issue that around getting information on who was really behind political ads that you see on TV, and because of a series of court cases and legal changes in recent years, first of all, the limits on how much money can be spent on these things have basically been eradicated. But also, it's become increasingly difficult to figure out who's actually putting up the money behind an ad when you see an ad for Joe Biden or Donald Trump. Like, who's actually paying for that? And also in state and local races. And so there was a kind of backdoor way to try to figure out who is behind these ads, because the people purchasing the ads had to make certain disclosures to TV stations. And so some of my colleagues and I had kind of latched onto that as a way to try to tell the public who was behind these ads. And there were some of the TV stations that were involved and the media companies that owned them basically didn't want this disclosure regime to be in place or wanted to limit access to it. And so we sort of spent much of 2012 writing about that. Unfortunately, I think if anything, the terrain on the campaign finance front in terms of transparency has probably gotten even worse since then.
I also thought that you would be a perfect person to ask if Democrats pump as much dark money into politics as Republicans. I'm not sure if it's a fair question. So,
I don't actually know the answer. My guess is that I think it probably depends on the race you're looking at. I seem to recall that Joe Biden may have actually received more dark money, meaning money that which we can't figure out the true provenance of than Donald Trump in 2020. I believe that's the case. My guess is that generally speaking, there's more of it on the Republican side, but there might be some prominent exceptions to that. And certainly you see it on both sides. I mean, I think there's just a class of kind of super rich donors, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, that if we collectively allow them the option to exert their influence anonymously, then they will take that option, and that's how a lot of this works these days.
Yeah. So you've mentioned that you are more driven by reporting than by writing, and that was actually one of my questions. I was wondering, does the form in which you present your material matter to you, and do you find pleasure in writing, or would you easily be okay like doing it over the radio, TV, or any other form?
Well, I actually have worked over the years with some radio reporters, which has been really satisfying experience. There's an NPR investigative reporter named Laura Sullivan who did the Red Cross stories with me. And the way we worked was that she produced radio audio pieces, and I simultaneously wrote print pieces, and then we sort of published them at the same time. The print piece was published the same day as the radio piece was aired. And so we sometimes do kind of cross media collaborations like that. I enjoy writing. I mean, it's satisfying to try to, present your findings on the page. But as I said, at least for many of the stories I do, there are some limits to the to the ways that you can write a story because, you know, for example, just to take the Intuit story about TurboTax, I mean, there are some interesting characters, executives at that company, the current CEO of the company, the founder of the company who was the CEO for many years, who it would have been great to be able to, you know, fly out to California, sit down with them, interview them in person, you know, maybe even shadow them for a day or something like that, a few days. But they just would not agree to that when they once understood sort of what we were, you know, what we were writing about. Mm-hmm. And so that it does make it more difficult, not impossible, more difficult to have kind of rich scenes, you know, with involving those people, unless maybe there's a lawsuit or something, some way that you can find to sort of to fill out portraits of people you're writing about that don't involve actually talking to them, which is the way that it would work in most reporting.
Do you think that you are more or less excited about journalism now or 10 years ago when you were starting with ProPublica, and also how your views on the media evolved during this decade?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's sort of the industry is in sort of a constant state of change. But I guess the main thing I would say is that I feel very lucky to be at ProPublica, which is, you know, where I have the whole organization, including my editors, are devoted to, you know, serious and fair investigative journalism. And we have the kind of time to try to produce stories that are that are serious and in-depth and fair. Mm-hmm. So I, it's a great place to work. And, you know, we're obviously all hoping that the industry finds some kind of place of stability.
Do you think that this formula of nonprofit that ProPublica uses works? And do you think we're going to see more outlets like that?
It's very hard for me to say. I try to keep my head down and not think about the business side of media as much as possible. So I'd hate to speculate.
Yeah, it sounds that your job requires a lot of patience. Both with the sources and also with the FOIAs and a lot of waiting. Yeah. Justin, thank you so much for talking to us. We were talking with Justin Elliott for Cover Story for New Books Network. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.